That was the new single from Rudy called Gutted. And I've probably blasted that one like already 20 times in my bedroom. What an amazing song. And so good to hear Rudy play on the weekend. They killed it live. You can see Rudy play again this weekend. They're playing on Friday at the Ada, which is 555 Gore. And they're playing with Kid Monday and Bell Tower. So that's Friday, October 22nd at the Ada, 555 Gore. Check out Rudy. And also Kid Monday, last time I saw him play, he did a cover of The Killers, When You Were Young, which is obviously one of the best songs to hear live ever. So live music on Friday, and then also live music happening Sunday, same venue, Cyrus Jordan and a bunch of other people. That's all I have for Deliberate Noise today. Tune in again next Monday at 5 for more Deliberate Noise. Thanks so much to Ruby and Rowan for letting me interview you. And stay tuned to CITR in 1 hour. Exploding Head Movies with Gak will be on. Catch you later. Stay warm this week, guys.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, everybody. I am the Orca Man, Fred, and today I'm here with Erica Wirth. She is the host of a podcast called Breaching Extinction, and she is also a naturalist down at a whale watch company in Monterey Bay. Is there anything else that you'd like to introduce yourself with? I'll leave that to you for a second.
I feel like that definitely covers the professional stuff. Also, Pom Mom, have a Pomeranian named Peaches. That's always important to add. She will probably interrupt this at some point. So
we love it. If you
let people know.
Yeah. If you haven't yet, follow Peaches Humps on TikTok. I think it might be my absolute favorite account. Not going to lie.
I'm a content creator. not really. Yeah, the title's pretty self-explanatory. Go check it out yourself, but it's pretty funny. And my dog just does that a lot. So yeah,
what an absolute queen.
Yeah, exactly.
That's too wonderful. Okay, so did you do any naturalist work? We're just going to jump right into it. Did you do any naturalist work before you went to Monterey?
Yes. So I worked as a naturalist in Washington on Orcas Island for a whale watching company there. I was half kayak guiding and half whale watching. I've worked as like an environmental interpreter though for quite a while, which basically is just like an educator, but like at a zoo or aquarium. And so I started when I was like 14, did a lot of that, but like officially became like a whale watching naturalist in 2019.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's also this is going on, 2 years now or three? I don't know.
I guess 2019, 2020. I guess like going at the end of the year will be like 3 years. Yeah.
Okay. That's, well, one, commend you for that. That's like decent amount of time in the system already. Also, two, going from 14 in terms of environmental, even just say education at the whatever levels you were at before. That's a lot. Where were you before you went to Orcas Island for that kind of work?
Before I was in Orcas, I was doing an AmeriCorps program in Arizona because at the time I thought I wanted to work with African animals. And I was like, I'm going to get land experience, but my heart really is at sea. And so that didn't work out so well for me. And here we are. But I got started at the Columbus Zoo when I was 14, volunteering and just like doing very basic education stuff. And when I was like 16, they gave me a scholarship to go study polar bears in Canada. And it was like then that I realized that this is like what I wanted to do with my life, was like something with the environment and like seeing the polar bears in their natural habitat, learning that they were endangered. I was like, this is it. And I've always, just because I started in environmental education, it's always come very naturally to me. So it was always like an easy job to pick up in college. So I was at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium for a bit, and that was probably out of like all the, you know, institutions that I've worked for, I think that one was my favorite. I really like believe in their mission, and they had a lot of really awesome educational programs like that they offer there. So it was pretty amazing. Yeah, so that's pretty much what we've done.
That's good. For the Clearwater Aquarium, when you talk about their mission with that, what do you like about it? Like, if there, what was it specifically that you saw? You were like, oh, this is fantastic.
So their whole thing is rescue, rehabilitation, and release. So, okay. Have you seen the movie Dolphin Tale?
Yeah.
Okay. So Dolphin Tail, it's that dolphin, Winter the Dolphin. So she's the one that had her tail cut off, and she was wrapped in monofilament, and they rescued her over in Cape Canaveral and then brought her over to Clearwater Marine Aquarium because it was like one of the few places that had space. Cause in Florida, they kind of have a network and they're like, where is the quickest place that we can get this animal? And they sent her there and kind of like built around that. Like they were always like a smaller facility, but she definitely brought a lot of attention to the facility.
Definitely.
She's the one that's got the prosthetic tail, but they have otters, dolphins, and turtles, and all of the animals that are in their facility are in need of rehabilitation, or if they can't be rehabilitated, they are permanent residents, and Winter is a permanent resident there.
Yeah.
But they have like a sea turtle hospital that you can walk through, and it has like the that glass where it's like you can see through but the animals can't see you.
Okay.
And I just think that they are very much like on top of their mission of like teaching people about their natural environment, and like they're not shy about talking about the impacts that humans have on wildlife and like inspiring stewardship. And then another thing that they like do too is a lot of times we would have like disabled veterans or other people with disabilities come in, and they would get to like interact with Winter or like watch her do her swimming. So there would be like, there were multiple times at work, I would be like in the middle of a task and I'd look over and there's like some kid or some veteran like interacting with this dolphin, having some life-changing experience. And I'm just like crying in the corner. I'm like, oh my God. But like, there were some amazing experiences there. Like I remember hearing a story of like a kid that was completely nonverbal and like made some sort of noise or something like that when they interacted with Winter. So like, I just think that that institution really knows like what it's about and has a very high emphasis on education and like involving people with their issues. Obviously, like, you know, no place is perfect, but I would say that like, that is the standard to hold yourself to as a Clearwater Marine Aquarium.
That's a pretty beautiful one too, as well. Well, one of the things that you just said there was like, with regard to the start of them really like building up their business, so to speak. Is it a nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit, yes.
All right, so them building up the nonprofit, it was based upon the idea of rescue and rehabilitation. Like from what you said right there, it's like once they started with Winter, it was like, oh no, this is a viable nonprofit model that we can actually do and provide a lot of good for. That's an amazing beginning of an organization that I don't think has been done much at all.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely like around, it was like a very small thing in the beginning, and Winter is what made it bigger. Like, because Winter, obviously, like that's a really fascinating story about a dolphin with a prosthetic tail, you know? And I'm trying to think back to like all the details and I can't remember all of them, which I should, because I was a tour guide for them. But yeah, I just like, you know, I think it's a great facility. It's definitely a smaller facility, but, you know, I think that overall they do a really good job, and it is a really special place to work and to go. And I would highly recommend that anybody who has the opportunity to go do it. And also it's like, if you want to donate to an institution, that would be a great one. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's in Clearwater, Florida. Yeah.
Yes.
Beautiful. Yes. Beautiful. All right. So fast forward a little bit, and then you get into Canada, which is where I am currently. Shout out the Great White North. Where did you go for the polar bears? And let's start there. One, where did you go for the polar bears?
So I was 16 and I went to Churchill, wow, Manitoba, Canada, which is the polar bear capital of the world. And it's actually where I saw my first whale. I wasn't expecting to see any whales. We were like walking around this park. We saw like an Arctic fox that was like very curious about us. Mm-hmm. And then we look off over into the Hudson Bay and I see all these little white things popping up out of the water. And I asked the guy, I was like, what is that? And he was like, those are belugas. And I start bawling. It was like hundreds of belugas. And I was like, oh my God. But also, one sees that. Yeah. I was like, we didn't see them very close. Like I literally, it was just like dots from far away, but nonetheless, it was amazing. And then we were like, we were talking to different scientists. It is a program like for teens. And so I met like, I think about 10 other people there. It was like, from different zoos or aquariums, and then like 10 teenagers from zoos or aquariums. And we were called Arctic ambassadors. And basically they taught us about the polar bears and the history of the polar bears and the history of the culture in that area. And we got to interact with some locals and learn about what it's like to live in the polar bear capital of the world, which is cold, of course, but also very interesting, as you might expect.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, like so it's kind of like, it's common there for everyone to leave their car doors unlocked and their house doors unlocked, because occasionally like there will be polar bears just in town and you just need to like get into a vehicle or something to get away from them. And there's actually a rule that you can't dress up as a polar bear for Halloween because they don't meet any mistakes on if it's a real bear or if it's like something else. Yeah. So pretty crazy.
I also can only imagine like the first person that did that something went wrong where they're like, yeah, we can't do this.
anymore. Yeah. No, that's totally fair. Like they actually have a polar bear jail is what they call it too. So it's this facility in town that when the polar bears wander in, they basically capture them, stick them in this cage, and then like, this sounds really mean, but I promise it makes a lot of sense. And like basically starve them for not long enough to kill them, of course, but like enough to deter them from wanting to come back to the area. And then they will basically like tranquilize them, put them in a plane or a helicopter, take them off somewhere else. And one of the guys that worked there said that he, cause like, if you give them food, they'll keep coming back. So like, that's a very dangerous idea, which is why they kind of do that starving thing, which like sounds mean, but like it makes
all the sense in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And he said there was like one time that he had two polar bear cubs. Like there was a mom in one plane and then two polar bear cubs in his little plane. And they started to wake up while he was flying.
Oh God.
And I was like, rip. I feel like a polar bear cub though, like that's definitely less of a threat. Like still for sure. Is a threat. Like that is like extreme danger, like small baby bear while we're literally flying. Hello.
Still, like, there's not a lot of helicopters that are that big that I can imagine they're renting out for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's a whole ordeal up there. Like the polar bears are absolutely a part of everybody's life up there because it has to be. Yeah. So it's really fascinating. He even had like the guy that was giving us a tour, he had this truck and there was a big dent in the front and it was because a polar bear literally charged his car and like jumped God. On it.
Oh, my Lord.
I mean, which like, if you're an apex predator and a person is like coming for you, it makes sense. Like it does, you know?
Oh, yeah. Not a question. And also too, like the guy who's driving, depending on whether or not you're on a road or not, like that's, if a polar bear is coming at you, there's only so much you can do. Like you can't really throw yourself into reverse that fast, especially, yeah. I don't know, depending on how fast you're going, whatever. Like that is a maneuver that might hurt you and the bear more.
Right. Almost. Yeah, definitely. So very interesting place for sure.
No, it sounds like it. Also too, it's one of the places that it's interesting because even in Vancouver, I see there's a very distinct, the thing I always tell people when they come and visit it, or even people that I've like seen here for a while, it's like one of my favorite parts about Vancouver, one of the most interesting, is that when you look from Kitsilano or Point Grey, a lot of the beaches along this side of Burrard Inlet across to North Vancouver. In North Vancouver, there's a line of suburbia that ends. And beyond that, it's just forest. But even with that, like, as much as there's nothing beyond there except for the North Pole, we as a city don't collectively live within the nature as much as I think we think we do. Yeah. Like, it's not as much in collaboration consciously, at the least. Whereas in some place, like the place you went in Manitoba, you're sitting down and everybody's actively thinking about it every time they enter their car.
Yeah. Definitely. Most definitely. Like, you always got to be vigilant, you know, making sure there's not a polar bear around.
It's very, very special problems to have, at the least.
Absolutely.
All right. So after that, you end up, you're like, okay, the sea is the way to go. You finish up high school and then university down with Clearwater, I'm imagining, as well.
I went to Eckerd College in St. Pete, Florida. So it was like, that was like the moment I like, remember looking this polar bear in the face, up to our tundra buggy, stretched her paws out, looks at us, and I'm like probably 4 feet from this polar bear.
Oh God.
I'm in a safe place, so it's fine. And I'm just like locked eyes with her. And I was like, this is it. Like, that was the moment that I was like, there's nothing else for me. And it's kind of funny that, like, I think it's, I don't know, in a way symbolic that the polar bear was the first thing that I saw, because I keep, like, I've always teetered on the, I'm a generalist. I love all animals. I've always been a little bit more drawn to marine life, mm-hmm. but polar bears are technically a marine mammal, but they walk that fine line. And so I just always thought that that was kind of funny that that was the beginning of it. But I went to Eckerd College in St. Pete. I studied environmental studies and psychology, and Eckerd was like such a tremendous experience. I was so fortunate to be able to go to that college. There's no place like it. It's like a liberal arts STEM sort of thing that focuses on like marine science, environmental studies. That's like their two main programs. And it's a very small school, like 1800 students, mm-hmm. but the amount of opportunities that I had there for research, for study abroad, and like, I got a lot of scholarships to study abroad. I loved Eckerd. I like recommend it to like anybody. The only thing with Eckerd is it's so expensive, and I was fortunate enough to get scholarships, but like it definitely is pricey. But
As state schools are in general, like there are states schools within the states in general.
Yeah, definitely. But it was awesome. I learned so much there. I always like, you know, I did the environmental studies track because I was unsure I wanted to keep my options open on whether or not I wanted to go into marine science or not, because I also, and I'm sure you probably heard this too, like immediately when you tell people that you want to do marine science, they're like, you can't do that, that's hard, you're never going to make any money, like just like immediately, like they're like, this is not a real career. And so I definitely kind of bought into that a little bit, and I was like, well, I still want to work with animals, so like I'm going to play it safe and do environmental studies.
Fair.
And then I did the psychology because, well, I took like one psychology class, and then I was like, this is really interesting, because we had to take a bunch of like perspective courses. That's one of the other things I loved about Eckerd. It's like, we didn't have gen eds, but we had perspective courses, which made us like very well-rounded students, I feel like. Like, you had to take classes from different disciplines. But I took a psychology class. I was like, this is quite interesting. And at the time, I was thinking maybe I wanted to be a zookeeper, some kind of animal trainer, which, you know, a lot of us want that at some point and learn that we don't want that actually. But a lot of people major in psychology. So I was like, cool, I find this interesting. And like, potentially this will help me get a career somewhere else. Definitely. And I absolutely use my psychology degree, but not in the way that I thought. I was like expecting to be like training animals. But now it's like, I go and I observe animal behaviors, and you know, also, I feel like I use my psychology degree more so to analyze human relationships with animals and like human relationships with the environment as a whole. So ultimately, I'm very glad that I did both of those majors.
Oh, that's huge. Well, we'll move on to one of the first things that comes to mind when you're talking about the psychology there. After, well, going on 3 years now for environmental education as a like professional career, so to speak, and doing it before, with regard to the psychology, right? Like, you have to have seen more than like 10,000 plus people that are beginning to enter beginning to enter into wildlife spaces and seeing how they view it, which is, I gotta be like absolutely incredible to see like so many different entrances into the realm, so to speak. Right?
That it is for sure. When I was on Orcas Island, it was almost all tourists. Yeah. And most of them had never seen orcas before. Like, most people had never seen whales. Like, and they were just excited to be there and like very fascinated. Like most of the people that we got out there were like brand new to whales. And now I work in Monterey and I have like regular passengers that like come out all the time. And I do think that one of the benefits of working for, so I work for two companies here, but for the main one that I work for is that I do have those regular passengers and I really value my time with them. But I definitely get more of a range of people here of like, some people have never seen an animal, people have seen whales a million times. And so it definitely is interesting. And I think that that can be both the best and worst part of my job.
Yeah.
Because I love when people see whales for the first time and when they're so excited and like, you know, I love it when I just have people that are grateful to be out on the water and grateful to be in nature. And I think that we always have better trips when we do, but I definitely like, I've become a little jaded and I've noticed that there are a lot of people with very unrealistic, very high expectations.
Definitely.
And I would say that that is probably the worst part of my job. of just some people think that the, like, they just expect a lot from the animals and they want to get, you know, they want to get shots of the animals and like, it's
expect more of them than like you or the animals could actively give them. It's just,
yeah, like I'll have people unrealistic like, almost. Can I see a blue whale? I've had that request multiple times. I've been able to fill it once. Because we were watching humpbacks and a blue whale just showed up. And blue whales are pain to watch anyways, because they just like take super long dives. They pop up far away. They're not up very long. They're not very interesting to watch. It's more of a novelty of like, okay, like you see a blue whale.
I saw it, yeah.
But I definitely like, you know, I'll have people like ask me like, you know, when the animals are going to breach, when they can book to see a breach. And I'm like, that's not, no. And it's like, you know, it just like hurts my heart a little bit. And I definitely am trying to be a little bit more patient with this, because some people just don't know and they are just excited. But I like also do experience people who just really feel like they, like if they don't get a breaching animal or a lunge feeding animal, that like their trip is not good. And it's just like,
well, it's that is about the epitome in my head of commodifying wildlife, outside of actively commodifying wildlife with regards to captivity, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's like, no, I am here explicitly for them to do something that I want to see personally. They were like, that is what I'm here for. If you had to see, there are passengers that are phenomenal and there are passengers that are not the worst, but they're harder to deal with, definitely. If you had to put genres of passengers, who is your favorite person to walk on that boat? And then like down the line, like these people are actually really fun. These ones, like they're neutral. Like if they show up, they're going to have a good time. It's like somebody's, I can only imagine like if I bring a friend, they're going to be like, yeah, this is cool. That's what I call neutral. If
you had my top regulars are my top for sure. Okay. Like, I love all my regulars. I'm like very grateful for them because like they all understand wildlife. You know, they go out enough with us to know that some days it's like life-changing and other days you just watch a whale sleep or you don't even see a whale at all. Like, and that's just the reality of it.
Definitely.
But I love having them come out and I would say they're the best. I had a group of Girl Scouts come out with me, a whole boat of Girl Scouts. That would take second place because they were so stoked and just like screaming the whole time. And it was so amazing to see these like 10-year-old girls like losing their minds over these whales. And we had like a calf that just like kept breaching. And I was like, these are the days when we need the calves breaching. Are the people who should see this. Like, you know, cause they
deserve
it and appreciate it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also think like Midwesterners or like people from some square state in the middle who have like not seen this kind of stuff. Like I'm from Ohio originally. And like, you know, also when we have our like check-in, people's phone numbers are there, and sometimes I'll like notice that like it's an Ohio zip or what is it called,
area code, whatever,
area code, yeah, and I'll be like, you're from Ohio, like and I'll be like, all right, we're gonna have a, like we're gonna see some cool things. But yeah, I would say like people that haven't seen a whale, kids, my regulars, and then people who just like are really curious and like ask all of the questions. I love that too. And then like, I enjoy, like, I definitely voice the unrealistic expectations a lot, but for the most part, I would say like 85% of my passengers are neutral to awesome.
Nice. Like, that's a good amount.
It's just like, there's these, like, there's, yeah, there's just like a culture around whale watching that I see that it just like feels weird. But yeah, it's like, I really don't, it's hard for me to be around people with really high expectations, because it's like, you know, sometimes people like want to get like super close and I'm like, we can't trust, I'm sure, but like, it's not, that's up to the whale, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but I mean, I've also been surprised by people too, where it's like, I feel like they're going to be really like, you know, entitled to a whale, and then we like have a conversation and they better understand. But I've just had so like a lot of experiences, or I've overheard a lot of experiences where people like are like, you know, wanting something else. Like I have a video of a breaching humpback calf, and literally as the calf is breaching, somebody's asking me, when is it typical to see orcas? Like, oh, or God, would it be likely for us to see orcas today?
Like, come on.
Yeah. So it's just, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's just like weird, because I feel like this should be a for fun activity, like learning and for fun. And like, it sometimes isn't. I'm definitely painting a very negative picture right now, but it's not that way. I do have a lot of really amazing days with like really amazing passengers who like I learn a lot from, and they learn a lot, and like we enjoy the whales, and like, you know, they leave and they want to help the animals, like, you know, because if the animals are so amazing that, you know, they're inspired to do something about it. So it's not all like that, but I just feel like I've been seeing a lot of that in the last like year or so. And it's just like something I constantly am thinking about.
I also feel too, that as of, I don't know, recent, within the past year and 2 years, especially within COVID, the clientele that are actually making their way out to this kind of stuff is extremely specific. Like there's only so many people that are able to make it out. I can only imagine there are so many people from the Midwest that are making their way out right now. A lot of kids, I guarantee parents are trying to keep them in as close quarters as possible, so it's not as easy to maneuver yourself to whale watch or stuff like that, which makes a difference.
Yeah.
Definitely. With regard to the conversations though, is there any one or few that like stick out in your head enough that you would remember them right now?
Like just like conversations with guests?
Conversations with guests where you either helped them, somebody was really, really excited for something and you helped them recognize the beauty of just being out in the water in general, or something that the guest, like a guest was able to, you were able to learn from them or otherwise that like really, really sticks out for some reason.
I definitely had like a passenger that didn't quite understand, just because of like, he'd seen a lot of breach shots. He was like, I want a breach shot. Like, when can I book for a breach shot? And he asked me like a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I just, the lesson that I learned was not to write people off so quickly.
Okay.
I can now see that he was just very excited. And, you know, he did keep asking, and the answer never changed. I'm like, just come out until you see it. That's all we do, you know? Like he seemed to, like one of the last times that I interacted with him, be like very understanding of animal behavior and things like that, like telling other passengers, like, cause we had a super amazing trip and he was like letting them know, like, this is not how it always is. And I'm like,
it's awesome.
He's getting it. So not all the time. Like I definitely, I've had like I don't necessarily like remember them in the moment, I don't think, like,
sure.
But I would say probably that one would be like a good example of like, okay, like, because like I definitely have gotten like very jaded by it, because I feel like it's like constant of like, when are the whales gonna breach, or like, I want to see a blue whale, or I want to see a orca, and I'm like, it's not happening. And like, and the thing is, like, it's not that like you can want those things and that's fine, but it's when people get upset about it, like genuinely upset, is like where I'm like, ugh. But yeah.
Well, it gets harder because you cannot manage their expectations. All yeah. you can do is like talk to them and feel it out from there.
Yeah.
It was funny. I was actually talking with a guy from TikTok who I'm trying to get to come out to Friday Harbor soon. I think he's going to come out in October. And he was at like, we were originally supposed to do it next week. And he kept like, he's like, he said that a bunch of stuff came up in September, didn't end up happening. I told him like the opportunity of us actually seeing orcas is going to be extremely low the further we get into the season. It's like, I want to let you know, because if your goal is to come out here and see orcas, then I want to make it the best opportunity that's possible, but it still needs to be understood that that isn't exactly going to happen.
Yeah.
And he came right back and said, no, like it's going to be fun just to be in the place, just to go yeah. out and do that kind of thing in general is going to be enough of a phenomenal experience that it's worth it. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, wow, like even I, when I first came out to the PNW to try to see orcas, like I didn't have that kind of mindset. And so I really, as soon as I heard that, I was like, wow.
Yeah. No, I think that's, and a lot of people do have that mindset, which is good. And I definitely like try to set expectations. Like, and I think a lot of us naturalists have started trying to set expectations in the safety chats of like, you know, there's a chance we don't even see a whale today. We're going to see water. We're going to see clouds. And then we can only go up from there, you know?
Definitely.
And you know, it definitely it's an awesome experience when you have those really appreciative people that are just like, I'm just happy to be here. And the thing is like, we just have to understand like, you know, that whales, while they are really awesome and do really awesome things, they're not going to do it all the time. And like,
of course,
they need to rest. And also like, we are literally going into the actual wild. Like you can't control that, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, enough about all of that, but like, just manage your expectations, you know, don't expect too much from the animals, because, you know, I feel that we're already privileged enough to be out and go to share like space with them.
Yeah.
That we should be as like respectful and grateful as possible in those environments.
For sure. And also too, the gratefulness there, it's like, it's half of the appreciation that I've even had walking away from any experience that I've had either like on land seeing wildlife or on trips.
Yeah.
Like the gratitude or the appreciation of just like, oh my God, I am in the waters where these are moving through. Especially, so the thing is, humans, that we don't really think about is that we have the crazy opportunity to move through space kind of unimpeded.
Yes.
Like you're originally from Ohio. If any other animal in the world tried to make their way from Ohio to Florida to Monterey and that, like, and also to the San Juan Islands, that would be nearly impossible without human help. Like no matter what, like the way that right. we are able to maneuver ourselves through space is absolutely insane. I don't think people recognize that as much.
Yeah, definitely.
So you also said that when you were in college, you did study abroad.
Yes.
Where was that?
So I studied abroad 4 times in college.
Nice. Well done.
Yeah. Eckerd had a 414 program. So okay. It was like 4 and/or 5 classes in the fall semester, a month long, 1 class in January, and then 4 classes to 5 classes on the spring semester. And so cool. The first time I went abroad, it was in 2016. I went abroad 3 times in 2016 and once in 2017. So I did a winter term to Roatan, Honduras, where I studied tropical marine environments,
mm-hmm.
which was so awesome. It was like, we basically just like learned about the ecosystem there and coral and the different species that they have. And then some of our tests, not all of them, but part of them were like going underneath the water, and they would like put like little numbers by like a rock near where coral is, and you had to like go use your little underwater notepad to identify the species.
That's wild.
A lot of fun. And then that following summer I went to Indonesia on a research grant to go study mangroves.
Okay.
And so we went to a couple different islands. We were there for about 5 weeks. We were collecting data on plots that were previously surveyed in other years, new plots, and they had planted, they were trying to figure out which mangroves, like the species depth and elevation that they were going to be best for helping to irrigate fish ponds. Mm-hmm. And we went to go collect data on that, and then the fishermen had like moved all of the plants around because they didn't quite understand what we were doing. Uh-huh. That was inconclusive. But the other ones, we were basically going out and surveying different areas to see, like we were getting basically the height and the species, and we had plot lines that we would go through, and we were trying to determine which ones have the highest level of survivability and mm-hmm. which ones are going to do best in those environments. But I mean, mangroves originated from Indonesia, so it was like remarkable. And in Florida, we only had 3 species. There's like way more species in Indonesia. And so that was my like introduction to research. That was my first research project. And while mangroves were not the thing that I wanted to study, I fell in love with the research process there. Cool. And like learned that like science was something that I could do. Definitely had heard growing up that it was like really tough and you have to be really smart and special and like to an extent, but you know, with hard work anybody can do anything that they want, I think. Yeah.
I feel like you are one of the major testaments of that, at least of all of the people that I've met ever.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course,
I appreciate that. And then from there on, I spent a semester in Tanzania where I studied wildlife management and policy.
Crazy.
And we had class 6 days a week. We had like a 6 p.m. curfew. So it was like not your standard study abroad, like
by no means
Europe sort of thing. We were like in the bush, like conducting different types of research. And I would highly recommend the School for Field Studies to anybody like who has a chance to go, because like they will show you a lot of different research techniques. Like all of us participated in a bunch of different techniques, like interview style research. We also did like different plot lines, track lines, identifying animals. And then I did a behavioral study on baboons at the end. Everybody does their own like independent research project. And that was amazing. And I fell in love with Africa, and I was probably depressed for like 2 years after I came back because I just wanted to go back so bad.
Yeah.
And I like applied to so many things. That's what kind of led me to Arizona to do AmeriCorps, which I would not recommend AmeriCorps. I didn't have a great experience. Other people I've heard are not like, there are better ways to be more financially stable and get skills.
If you had to explain to me and the audience right now, because I'm not exactly sure what AmeriCorps is actually.
AmeriCorps is basically like the Peace Corps in the United States in sure. a sense, but basically they give you opportunities to go work in places and they like house you and they give you like, I think I had like a stipend of like $200. It was like bi-weekly or every week or something, which is like really not enough to live on, even if you're housing. So it just was like kind of took away like from like the experience, because I had to have like another job. It was like super exhausting. Mm-hmm. But anywho, not the point, but basically I went to AmeriCorps because I was like, I want to work with African animals. And like, this is experience like with a national park on land and like sure. whatever. And so it's funny because like that was really like the only like negative job experience that I had had where I was like, I hate this, you know? And like, I would apply to a bunch of things that were like Africa related. I would apply to like 10 things and I would apply to like one dolphin thing and I would always get the dolphin thing and I would always be so annoyed. I'd be like, oh my God, like I should go to Africa. I know it's such a silly thing to complain about. But now I've just kind of like accepted that this is like the work that I'm going to be doing and I definitely love it. And like, I still love Africa and I'll probably get back there one day, but just not today, you know?
Well, also too, it's like, it's the kind of thing where it's one thing to complain about, but also too, you've set yourself up in the situations where that's even possible.
Yeah.
Which it's the biggest thing. The majority of the people that I've talked to in general, it's like a lot of people in the marine science field, you underestimate yourselves with regard to like, it is genuinely impressive. One, the stuff that you've accomplished, but two, like applying to 10, I know college graduates that haven't applied to 10 jobs, like let alone opportunities in different countries, continents, or otherwise were like, oh no, I'm incredibly passionate about this and I want to go forward. So commend you for that fucking 1,000.
Well, thank you. I just like...
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
When you were in... I'm just going to bring it completely back to the next thought I had. When you were in Orcas Island... You had gone there, not from Monterey. You had gone there from...
Okay, where? So here's the line.
Yes.
We'll just do the timeline.
Let's do it.
Born in New Mexico.
Done.
Moved to Ohio.
Okay.
Did the zoo. Moved to Texas my last year of high school, my senior year. Went to college in St. Petersburg, Florida at Eckerd.
Yeah.
Got my first internship, well, not my first after graduation internship at Moat Marine Lab with the Sarasota Dolphin Research Project.
Where was that? Sarasota, Florida?
Sarasota, Florida, yes. Cool. And then went to AmeriCorps to go do that.
In Arizona.
Yeah. Then moved back home for like 5 months.
Home there was Ohio?
Yeah, okay. Moved back home for a little bit to like regroup, reassess like what is going on.
Yep.
Took a trip to Friday Harbor in March of 2019.
Yeah.
Fell in love with it. Had an amazing naturalist who told me everything that I wanted to know. Like I knew nothing about orcas at the time. And like she's... Okay. I remember seeing Stanley. That was the first whale that I saw. Uh-huh. We were the only boat on the water that day that saw whales because it was still a little bit early in the season. And then she was also like telling me about how like up there they keep their distance and they do all of these things and how it's like highly regulated up there, which was definitely very appealing to me.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, well, I gotta get up here. And I applied to every company. Most of them do their hiring in like November.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sliding in like March, like, hello.
Is there any chance?
And there was a chance because some kayak/naturalist person dropped out at the company I ended up working for. They need one more person and they took me. So I moved out there in May of 2019. So I was like, I saw it and I moved out there like 2 months later, and then I stayed until December. So I was only there about 6 months. And like the whale watching here is way more seasonal than it is in Monterey.
Oh, for sure.
And so, yeah, so I basically, well, like at the time I was, a little spicy, and somebody told me that I was not qualified for jobs in Monterey. And so I was like, I need to go prove them wrong. And then I applied, which I was going to do anyways, but like at a later date, you know?
Sure.
And then I got a really spectacular job offer from the company that I now work for. And then I was like, well, it would be dumb for me not to take this. And then I moved here and the rest is history.
Lovely.
And I love Monterey. This is such a beautiful area and such a special place. I mean, Orcas Island was so special and amazing too. But like, you know, I've been pretty transient for the last couple of years. And like, this is the longest I've ever stayed in a place. I have no plans to leave anytime soon. I'm always open to like other opportunities, but I really have fallen in love with Monterey, and I do love my job a lot and the community that I have here, and the nature that I have here. Like we're like 20 minutes. I'm 20 minutes north of Big Sur, like, and the freaking Monterey Bay is my backyard.
Yeah. You keep on bragging about that one.
I know. It's so nice. But yeah, I think like, and culturally it's a really nice place too. Like just people are friendly. It's a small town, but it's not like kind of
incredibly small. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's, yeah, it's excellent. But that's how we got here. And then I've been on the boats for the last like 2 years almost. Gotcha. I don't know. With COVID, I don't know what time is. And like, also with this point in the season, when it's like you work almost every day, I'm like, I don't know what day it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, but it's been pretty spectacular. And I would say Monterey Bay is like a very special place for whale watching. I would say it's the best in the world. I'm probably biased. But
in terms of consistency, it sounds like it. Or consistency, and also too, of everything that I've seen from you being there, like even for the short time that we've known each other, the stuff you've come across is absolutely incredible.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Like in the San Juan Islands, we saw a lot of whales breathing from far away, which is awesome.
Of course.
Like in general. But here, like but that's like the complicated thing with the expectations, is because there are some times where it's like, I will have 2 weeks straight of a breaching whale every day.
Yeah.
Or I'll have like 2 weeks straight of like, maybe we see a whale, maybe we don't. And like, you just don't know. But like the action that we get here is like next level. Like we did not get this kind of action up in the San Juan Islands. Like there, I can think of like three encounters in the San Juan Islands that were like, oh my God, amazing. Like that whale got super close. That whale like jumped out of the water or something like that. It's like, I'll probably see a whale breach like a lot. I don't like, I see a humpback whale do something every day. Like there are five main behaviors that like I say that, you know, I see out here.
Yeah.
And there have been trips that we see all five behaviors, or we see four out of the five behaviors. And like, you just get so much. And also the bay is very healthy. Like that's the other thing that's like pretty
amazing. Massive deal.
Yeah. Cause there's a lot of like the Salish Sea is not healthy. Like, and that's another, like that's another reason why I don't want to be up there and like, just like, you know, contribute. I feel like, you know, I have the privilege of watching healthy whales and like showing people healthy whales, and I'm going to do that. Keep, you know, if it becomes unhealthy for the whales, then we reassess and go from there. But I mean, the Monterey Bay, like, so in the 1800s, there was this woman named Julia Platt, who was the mayor of Pacific Grove, which is the town just south, like one town south of Monterey.
Yeah.
And she was like, she studied zoology, and basically she couldn't get a job in academia. And so like in the last bit of her life, she became the mayor of Pacific Grove. And at the time, there were a lot of sea otters being hunted. The sea otters actually used to span all the way up to you, the southern sea otters up to British Columbia. And they were nearly hunted to extinction by the fur trade. They could not, you know, reproduce quickly enough for the demand of the fur trade.
Yeah.
And so that was actually one of the first species to be protected by Julia Platt, which like, how badass is that for a female mayor in like the 1800s? I mean, late 1800s, but still.
Yeah, that's still insane.
And she like Monterey, I would say that Monterey Bay is a healthy ecosystem because of her pioneering that. Like you know, she put a lot of protections in. That was her goal. Like, she was very stealthy in the way that she did it. But
it sets the standard.
Yeah, it sets the standard. And so, like, today we, I mean, obviously the numbers are not what they used to be, and I don't know that they ever will be.
Of course.
But we, like, it definitely is a pretty healthy bay for the most, like, compared to other places, you know?
Well, also to compare to, had you, compared to, had she not and everybody after her protected it the way that they have.
Yeah. And at the, like, least. That's a, like, I think it's a lesson that we have to learn from the Monterey Bay is, like, it's worth preserving because, like, you can see, like, I mean, I think this is just, like, a theory that I have, but, like, okay, potentially my sightings here are better, one, because the animals are feeding, so they have, like, calories and energy and whatever, but, like,
for sure,
if a whale is healthy and not, like, the southern residents where it's worried about, like, dying and stuff, you know, you're gonna have more energy to expend, like, moving around and, like, having, like, amazing encounters and things like that. And that's not at all what it's about. Like, we got to protect the bay for the bay's sake, not for us enjoying it's sake. But, you know, the Monterey Bay is a testament to, like, why it's important to be very strict with protecting marine environments and preserving them. And you can see, like, definitely when you come here versus when you go other places, like, you can see the difference in the ecosystem and, like, you can see the difference in the way that the animals behave and how healthy the bay is in general. So, you know, just always something to be mindful of.
Well, with the psychology, I'd be incredibly interested to see the difference too, that that would have on even the human populations that are around. It's the kind of thing even today. So my day job is a line cook, and at the bar that I work at, one of the managers, like, went to the back and we're cleaning out the house, just making sure everything is as polished as possible. But it's the kind of thing, like, when a place is clean, it's easier to keep it clean.
Yes.
So with regard to that, I can only imagine.
Yes.
Like, seeing the difference between in a place that is so, like, environmentally, like, healthy and rejuvenated, it's easier to keep it up running. And then more than that too, like, I can only imagine the effects that that have on the human populations that are around, when they're conscious about it, when they're thinking about it, versus in other areas, even around here, where it's, I was saying even before, it's not as a direct connection.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. And, like, even if you don't have the opportunity to have that direct connection, like, Carl Safina once said, like, you know, just start watching the birds in your backyard, or I can't remember, like, the exact thing that he said, but basically he was like, nature is everywhere. And, like, you know, you don't have to go into the wild to see it. No. And, like, you are in the wild. And, like, we've definitely habitated a lot of areas and, you know, kind of overtaken this planet, but it's still there, you know? And also nature is so resilient, like, you know, cause obviously I have the whole Breaching Extinction podcast and have, like, studied the southern resident issue in depth. And
definitely,
I've read, like, a lot of other papers too about, like, other species that were endangered and how they bounced back and things like that, because I'm like, well, how are we going to do it for these whales? And, like, if you give the animals what they need, they will bounce back for the most part. Like, nature is fucking badass and it's resilient as hell. And, like, it, like, I feel like if you do the right thing, there's no stopping it. But if you continue to do the wrong thing, then we're in a pickle, which we're in a pickle right now.
Holy shit. Well, in a number of ways, in a number of areas. It all depends on the scope that you want to look at for that one, between climate change, the southern residents, or otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'll have to think about. Okay, so we have a little under 10 minutes left. There's two questions that I really, or there's one question that I had before, and then questions about yourself and what you'd want to tell to the public in general. The first one, you were talking about the five behaviors of whales when you go out. What are the five behaviors?
The five main behaviors that I see from humpbacks that I would, like, consider cool surface behaviors are breaching, tail lobbing, like, head slap or chin slap, peck slap, and then friendly whale.
What's friendly whale? That sounds like an achievement.
It's the best behavior, or I don't know. It's the best one to experience.
Sure.
And the whale comes and swims by the boat really closely and just says hi. And then it's like, I've definitely left the boat, like, with whale snot just all over me. I actually got snotted on by an orca for the first time ever.
Really?
The other day.
That's not easy. Let alone like that never happens at all.
Yep. There was a male who it was a California Transit. He came right across, basically touched the bow, and it was not Bumper, the California Transient that is known for doing that. It was a different one. Sure. And then he comes behind the boat, and I was just like, he's coming under. So I go over there, and then he pops up right next to us, and just like spouts, and then just like goes on his merry way.
Crazy.
So yeah. That's wild. But those are the behaviors that we typically see. Those are the five main behaviors that I would classify. I've been debating on whether or not I should include kelping in that because I hadn't seen kelping until this season. But it is a thing. So maybe we all have six behaviors.
Well, you can have six, but you did call it like the big five. So yeah. it does make sense for those to be like the really, really solid, like.
Yeah.
The ones that you are one most likely to see, but two, like the most consistent at the least.
Yeah.
Consistent being used very loosely there. Yes. And like once every month is a lot for some of them, I can only imagine.
Like a friendly whale is very rare. Yeah. For sure, very rare. I definitely got super lucky last year and saw a decent amount of friendly whale behavior. But yeah, and there have been times where like I have to be like, okay, guys, like, because I can usually tell if it's about to happen. Definitely. Sometimes you can't, and they're just right there, and you're like, oh my god. But sometimes you can just see like they're slowly inching over, and a lot of times it's like a mom and a calf, and the calf is like, let me go say hi.
Of course.
But there have been a couple times where I'm like, all right, everybody, if the whale comes over here, you are legally not allowed to touch it.
Yes.
Like because sometimes they do get that close.
Yeah.
But that's the key, is they get that close. Like if you will never get that close to a whale unless they want it to.
Yeah.
You will never have a good encounter with a whale that where you get that close unless they allow it. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, also too, I can only imagine like for anybody that's thinking like, well, what if you bring the boat really close? The only thing I can imagine is that if you try to bring the boat close to a whale that doesn't want to interact, all it will do is dive and swim away.
Literally. Like,
that's it.
My best encounters almost consistently have been when we are sitting in the water with the engines off.
Yeah.
And when we are one boat, like it's just us, or there's one other boat with us, like one to two boats.
Yeah.
Typically one, like almost all of my best encounters have happened when we're by ourselves, engines off, sitting there, you know? So I think that that's the thing is like, if the whale feels non-threatened by you, you know, if you make it a quieter environment, you increase the likelihood of that happening, of like seeing those cool things. And like, obviously we don't want to encourage the boats or the whales to come up to the boats, like frequently or all the time, but like it is cool to get a quick pass, you know.
Definitely.
So.
Perfect. Well, before we sign off, I just want to thank you again for coming on for this hour. If you guys haven't yet, please check out Breaching Extinction podcast. Also too, we have an ongoing best whales thing that's going to keep going. Hashtag it's me, you, and hashtag the best whale right now. Yes. It's killer whales.
Yes,
we'll see if it remains. I guarantee there's gonna be more, but
we'll see. Yeah.
Well, you have your soft spot for humpbacks. I feel like you might alone bring that up.
I think that they're just objectively the best whale from an objective standpoint, you know?
I mean, rightfully so. You've seen the full five with them. Not only that, but you've also, I feel like you've gotten more comfortable with humpbacks than I know Kendra or I have probably.
Yeah. I didn't expect to love humpbacks so much, but yeah. I never had a favorite animal until I met the humpback whale. Because all the animals are cool. That's the thing. They all are cool in their own way. But most humpback whales are just objectively the best animal on the planet other than peaches. So.
Yes, peaches as a whole animal.
As a whole animal.
Individually.
Individually. She's the best.
Our princess.
Yes. But thank you for having me. And
of course.
I'm always happy to answer people's questions or have conversations and whatnot. So feel free to reach out, but thank you for having me, and also continue to listen to Fred's podcast and learn more about orcas. I know I've definitely learned a decent amount about orcas from you too. So it's pretty cool.
Do you want to plug anything else? I leave a little space. Anything else you want to, whether or not.
Yes. So obviously the podcast Breaching Extinction, but, if you are interested in supporting really awesome institutions that are doing good things for the community and the environment, please check out the Vermilion Sea Institute. They do a lot of amazing stuff for whale sharks and for their community. They're really big on empowering their kids in the community to